Why are chemists not poets? Take the chemists. By definition, synthesizers of molecules, dissectors of molecules, manipulators of molecules. For molecules read words. You have defined a poet. Why then are chemists seldom poets? Initially, chemists dilute. Eventually, they always concentrate, evaporate, distill to reach their goal. While some poets dilute, the best are thickeners. No wonder the German poet is a Dichter. They thicken, dichten, concentrate, distill, until the poem is compacted. Why then are chemists rarely poets? Chemists peer through safety glasses, working in fume hoods, behind explosion-proof shields, in a partial vacuum or in an inert atmosphere. Can you imagine a poet writing in such a verse laboratory? Writing sterile, non-explosive, non-inflammable, vacuous poems? Poems which, if they stink, are kept in a rarefied atmosphere to hide the stench. Now you know why there's no future for a careless chemist, a cautious poet.
That's internationally acclaimed chemist Carl Gerassi reading his poem, Why Are Chemists Not Poets? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
A recent reviewer in the Hudson Review called our guest, Carl Gerassi, the most obnoxious of things, a man gifted in both science and art. Renaissance man Carl Gerassi first earned his reputation as a scientist. A Viennese-born American chemist, Gerassi won the National Medal of Science for his work synthesizing the first steroid oral contraceptive, earning him the label of the father of the pill, and he won the National Medal of Technology for developing new methods of insect control. In addition to thousands of scientific publications, Carl Gerassi has been a prolific author of science in fiction, whether novels, plays, memoirs, or poems. Most recently, he has revised and released a series of poems exploring his painful, though temporary, breakup from his third wife, biographer Diane Middlebrook. A Diary of Peak, 1983 to 1984, has been released in a dual English-German edition and has been hailed by reviewers as lucid and brutally honest. His recent play, Insufficiency, examines murder, academic tenure, and the science of champagne and beer bubbles. Our guest today, as we explore his work in multiple disciplines and genres, is Carl Gerassi.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a little hard to know where to begin when there are so many avenues to your various activities. But let's start with this question about the difference between chemists and poets. And the idea that a chemist has to be careful, I guess, in order to survive, and a poet has to be anything but careful. At what point did you come to that insight?
Well, it was not a eureka moment. It was gradual because I learned it, I started to become a literatus only in my 60s. I don't mean 1960s, I mean my personal 60s. And it was only after already written nearly half a dozen novels, short story collection, and so on, that I realized that I was doing two things with literature. I first thought I just would like to lead a different intellectual life, late in life, rather than becoming just old chronologically, try to at least rejuvenate myself through some other intellectual activity. But I then justified it by saying, well, I'll be an intellectual smuggler. I will smuggle ideas, because I write science in fiction, as I said, not science fiction, ideas about scientists, about scientific behavior, about what science is all about, in the guise of fiction, for people who are either not interested in this or claim they don't understand it or don't even think about it. And I thought if I'm going to write an engaging novel, or short story, or play, that will get them to read it, and if it's good enough that they finish it, whether they like it or not, have learned something in the process. That was a simplified intellectual justification of mine for starting that. But at the same time, I wrote also two autobiographies, which is actually quite a lot.
Yes, it is.
But one was addressed more or less to scientists. It was in a series of scientific autobiographies. And the second one, which is a very good one, which I published about exactly 20 years ago, which is called The Pill, Pygmy Chimps and Degas Horse was really done in the instigation of my wife, who was a very important component of all these decisions, Diane Middlebrook, whom we mentioned in the introduction, who was a professor of English at Stanford, 16 years younger than I, and who met me when I was in my 50s and wanted to know something about that earlier life of mine. And she was obviously curious and persuaded me to write an autobiography by saying, look, you lived at an absolutely crucial period in really history. I was born in Vienna, and I fled in 1938 as a teenager, 14-year-old, during the Nazi acquisition. My parents were both Jewish. And I first went to Bulgaria in order to go to the United States and learned English in Bulgaria. And you'd think that's not the obvious place to do this.
Perhaps not.
And yet I went to an American school there, first-class one. So I had the advantage when I arrived a year and a half later here that I spoke English, and rather good English, except I always had an accent. These people claim I still have one. I, of course, don't believe it.
Oh, I don't hear a trace of it.
I don't believe it. But anyway, they claim that I did this. So I wrote that autobiography and realized, as I wrote that autobiography, that autobiography is a form of fiction, that it has to be a form of fiction,
sure,
that it is a form of auto-mythology, whether you like it or not. You cannot avoid it, because what you're doing, you're undressing in front of a public, and by undressing, you, of course, want to present yourself fairly attractively, whether you like it, whether you know it or not.
Sure.
Internal psychic filter that eliminates all kinds of things that never come out to the front. So it's an interesting genre, but it's not biography. It is really a form of fiction, very interesting fiction, called autobiography.
Sometimes of hagiography, too.
But then I realized a few years later, after I'd written quite a number of novels, and particularly now I finished, I have to admit this, about 2 months ago, another autobiography, 20 years later, which is a very tough title. It's called Treading on Shadows, the very last autobiography of Carl Gerasi. And I'm writing about the last 20 years, where I've become a very different person. And in looking, I suddenly realized that it is in my fiction, my plays, that I've really written about me in a very critical, appropriately critical way, sometimes sad, sometimes tough, about me and in different characters, that I didn't even know that I did all this in fiction, because only there do you really feel the freedom to disclose whatever you
right.
wish, because you know no one is going to know. It's simply, it's fiction.
It's sort and of I'm not, truth in fiction.
Right, and I'm not putting myself into one figure. I put myself in all kinds, particularly also into women. And that has become very important. I realized what it really has become for me is an auto-psychoanalysis. And again, psychoanalysts will say it's impossible. Well, it is possible if you're a fiction writer or a novelist or someone who can hide, who can have this inquisitional process between the analyst, who is the author, and the analysant, who is also the author, through the guise of fiction. And that's really what it's become for me. And that book has become very important for me, and I never would have thought to write a third autobiography. It sounds like megalomania. But it was my German publisher. You know, I write in English. Even my first language was German and had to be translated, although I speak very good German, but really not literary German. They decided to want to celebrate my, it's horrible to admit it, my 90th birthday next year. So this is really written, it'll come out in German translation. Now I hope that the publisher that I'll find an American or English publisher will also then publish the original English version. It probably won't come out my 90th birthday, it doesn't make any difference. But so I'm giving you a very long answer to really a simple question.
Well, just one more follow-up on that, if I may, the difference between autobiography and fiction in terms of revealing oneself, is it not more likely that a person would unwittingly reveal him or herself in fiction than in autobiography?
Yes, absolutely. But I've gone past that. There's no question that I did this probably during the first 15 of the 20-some years now that I've gone into literature. But now I realize it. And now I'm starting to do it deliberately. I'm quite sure that much of that was unconscious. Now it is very deliberate. And my last big book, which is the best thing I've ever written, it's called Four Jews on Parnassus. And there's no question, and I admit it in the foreword, that that is deliberate. You know, I write four Jews on Parnassus. Why would I write this? Well, I really wanted to ask what it meant to be a Jew. That's me. But there's a five-letter word and not a three-letter word. So what's that five-letter word? It's in quotation marks. Because I'm not religious, I don't come from a religious family, and yet I've, of course, been driven away from my home as a Jew, in quotation marks, and I've probably hidden or ignored this during my initial, let's say, 20 years as an immigrant, including when I was here, a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. I did not advertise it. I did not deny it, but I did not advertise it. I wanted to be assimilated American without any religious and other label connotations. Well, that has changed later on. And I now inquire, what does it mean to be a Jew? And I am that. I've never denied it, but now I flaunt it. And I decided to do this through four people who are Jews. On Parnassus, you know, it means they really were canonized and so on. So when people ask me, who are they? Well, if I'd ask you, you know, who do you think are four Jews that I might pick to write about? Well, the answer usually is Einstein. And then if it was Einstein, Sigmund Freud. And then it's not Sigmund Freud. Sometimes they ask Jesus. And I say, well, that's too early. And so, and then they have Karl Marx, for instance. And then they run out of candidates because then there are so many, you know, Freud and Einstein, obviously. And it's none of these. And it's about people that many university people know, but not the person in the street. Walter Benjamin, Theodor Adorno, Gershom Scholem, and Arnold Schoenberg. Of the four, Arnold Schoenberg is probably the one that most people know. Well, the thing that's unusual about them, they all were four were Jews, but Jews of a different type. One, Benjamin, never knew a German Jew or a Jewish German. Big difference. In the case of Adorno, his mother was Catholic. So officially, for Jews, he was not even Jewish. He even changed his name to his mother's name, Adorno, rather than his Jewish father's name, Wiesengrund. And yet the Nazis called him the Jew Wiesengrund. Didn't help him. So I called him a typical Jewish non-Jew. And then you have Gershom Scholem, who was in fact a very young Zionist. So you have the Zionist, and you have Schoenberg, and there was two of thousands and thousands of European Jews who converted. And he converted to Protestantism because he thought it was an advantage to him professionally. It didn't help him. And 20 years later, he converted back to Judaism. And if you look at Schoenberg's music, you see a reflection of that in the later pieces of his, which are really quite fascinating. So I said, well, what about me? Which one am I in this here? And that led me to a really interesting analysis, and it's a very good book. And it's a book that I decided to write entirely dialogically. So even though it's biographical inquisitions and descriptions of these four people, I do it in the context of a conversation which they're holding on Parnassus, a posthumous one. And the Parnassus that I invented for this is one where you can have internet, but you don't have email connections. So they know what is going on now posthumously with their work, with their ideas, but they cannot communicate with the people. They can only talk among themselves about this, which of course they do then. And then, and that was the important, really new thing I did in this case, I brought in their wives, because I always am interested in the roles of women in really basically male-dominated disciplines. These are all people of the last century. These were highly educated for women, and you know practically nothing about them. And yet all of them really, with one exception, helped their husbands greatly, who are world famous people. You know, you Google Walter Benjamin, you get 2.5 million entries. You Google Dora Sophie Benjamin, you're lucky if you find five or six. And yet she played a very important role. The same thing with Adorno's wife. So I really decided to write about this. And that, again, reflects a lot of things in my own life. Women have always played a very important role with me.
In the opening, I quoted from the Hudson Review that called you the most obnoxious of things, a man gifted in both science and art. It's unusual these days to find someone who can publish in the very specific discipline of, you know, chemistry, and then also turn around and write plays and poems and fiction. Do you find that your early background as a scientist, working on the pill, working on all kinds of things with hormones and insect control, how does that shape the way you approach language itself?
Not at all.
Not at all.
A lot of people have asked me this and would like to hear this romantic answer that it had affected us. Nothing. In fact, if anything, I think it would hurt you rather than help you for a very simple reason. But first of all, I want to remember, I didn't do these simultaneously for the first 62 years of my life. I had not written a single poem, not a single piece of fiction. I never had a desire to do so. And the instigation for this was not, again, a nice romantic one.
It was revenge.
I say it in the foreword to the poetry, but revenge. Revenge is a very powerful motive, but it's not a very good one. But to answer your specific question, think about it. Scientific writing, and I've published much too much in science, as many people said. I've published over 1,000 scientific articles over 50 years. Scientific writing is entirely information transmittal, and style counts for nothing, really, and content counts for everything. Furthermore, nowadays, English is the lingua franca in science, so everything is published in English, even by people whose English is very poor. This could be a Japanese or, I don't know, somewhere in Ulaanbaatar or in Burkina Faso. Makes no difference. But if it's good science written in poor English, it's an excellent paper. If it is elegantly written but is poor science, it's a lousy one. Well, this is not the case in fiction. First of all, style counts for a great deal, and sometimes even another superb one, well, books that are not really, the intellectual content is not fantastic, but the style may be so wonderful that you nevertheless do enjoy it, like a piece of chocolate, which is not fantastic truffle, but it's a good chocolate. And that is never the case in science. Point number two, since the 17th century, scientists, since the time of Galileo, scientists have not been permitted to use dialogue in their written discourse, nor have they allowed themselves to use it. Whereas, if you think about it, from the Greeks until, you know, about 16th, 17th century, let's say Erasmus of Rotterdam or Galileo himself, who wrote in dialogic form. These are not plays, but in dialogic form. We don't use that as a literary genre anymore, so the only thing that's left now for dialogic writing is the theater. That is one of the reasons why I moved into the theater, not by no means the only one. But you see, none of these prepared me for the thing that I greatly enjoy. I'm an autodidact, but I've learned a great deal. And my first novel, Cantor's Dilemma, which is, I don't know, now in its 29th print run, Penguin, is not my best novel, not the best written one. It is an interesting one. My first play is not the best play, but I've now written 9 plays. I've learned a great deal in the process. I've learned how to kill my literary darlings. I've learned how what you should not do, which takes quite some time. But I've learned none of this as a scientist. And even now, I have a certain didactic motive in my, as I mentioned to you, I want to be a smuggler. So my novels and plays, and I can tell you if one openly admits it, which is very dangerous, which is what I do, didactic is the most insulting term that reviewers usually use. They say, this is a didactic play or a didactic novel, meaning who the hell wants to still learn? I mean, you've gone to school long enough, you want to be amused and entertained or excited. Well, I disagree. I disagree. One can do both. The Latin poet Horace used to say it, you know, you can do both entertain and amuse and teach at the same time. But I'm much more subtle about the teaching aspects of it now than I was before in my first ones, where the didactic aspects became quite clear. That's incidentally why I call it science in fiction rather than science fiction, because everything I describe about science or scientists is real, and it's not imagined, not made up, because if it's made up as it can be in science fiction, and I'm not saying that one is better than the other, just the purpose different. I believe that science fiction is a flawed genre for didactic purposes. It can be didactic,
but often,
you never know what's real and what is not. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, whereas with me, when you read my books, I can guarantee you that what Jurassic writes is true. I mean, the play Insufficiency that will be performed today at the University of Wisconsin, which had its world premiere in London last month and ran for 30 days, deals with bubbles, with champagne and beer. And you think that's trivial. It turns out to be very complicated. But everything I describe about the science of bubbles is real, it's true. So you can guarantee that when you go to this play, you may laugh, you may be irritated, you may be excited and so on, but what you learn about the bubble part is true. And I believe that anyone who sees that, they'll never drink a glass of champagne or beer
again.
Well, no, they will drink it, but they'll think about something else.
Right, but then I would argue that your training as a scientist is showing up in your writing, because if you're writing about bubbleology and you're doing the research to make it accurate, to make it factual, than your scientific training and your respect for the truth.
Oh, you're completely right. You're completely right. And in fact, there's one other point. And actually, my wife made that point always. In my fiction and in my plays, I write primarily about the behavior of scientists, the very idiosyncratic behavior. You know, that we're not just Frankensteins and strangeloves or idiot savants or nerds, but that we are normal people, but there are certain aspects of our normal life that outside, for instance, my wife, an English professor, could never understand how do I have the temerity as a chemistry professor to put my name on papers with my doctoral students where I haven't done the work. And no English professor would ever do it. I'm giving you just an example. And then multiple authors, the order of authors, the priority, things like that, yeah. So that I can describe because I'm an insider. And I don't describe it as an investigative reporter who accuses people of something. It's as a mea culpa. And my colleagues have often accused me of saying that I'm washing dirty lab coats in public. And I say, of course I do, but it's also my lab coat. And we shouldn't be ashamed that if you work in a white coat, you are bound to get dirty. The important thing is to find out whether it's dirty you can wash out or whether it's so filthy that you cannot do so. Then you have a real problem. And we should talk about this. And there, of course, is an advantage to be an insider. You're completely right.
And a chemist would certainly know whether it can be washed or not.
Yeah.
We're going to dip into the poetry of Carl Gerassi when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. Everywhere I go, I find that a poet has been there before me. Comment of Sigmund Freud, quoted in a work by our guest, Carl Gerassi, who is known for his achievements in science and in the arts. He's being honored by the UW-Madison as a distinguished alumnus. And also, there are readings of his works going on in Madison and elsewhere. Let's talk about that quote that you, I think, mentioned in your preface to A Diary of Peak. Everywhere I go, I find that a poet has been there before me, that Freud says. How is it that poetry, in a way, can go beyond what maybe a psychoanalyst can? And what led you to turn to poetry?
Well, of course, as I said, it was revenge. But it doesn't make any difference. There's a very negative, powerful motive. You could also have very powerful, positive ones. I think that it chose poetry as the first genre or tool for my revenge was my third wife, the great love of my life, Diane Middlebrook, to whom I was married for 21 years until she died recently. But we lived together for a few years prior to that. She also had been married twice, even though she was considerably younger than I. And then one day, out of the blue, she announced that she'd fallen in love with someone else while she was on sabbatical at Harvard. So I didn't know that person. And then we were through in a very polite way, but it was brutal. So I'm saying it brutally. And I don't know who this man was, his name, but I knew that he was not a scientist. I always called him Literatus Manque, because he was certainly not a famous writer either. And I was just, it was a surprise. I was, to put it bluntly, pissed off. Very arrogant, egocentric Carl Gerassi said, well, my God, she has me, so how can she fall in love with anyone else? And particularly, why did I have no idea of it, that we're moving that direction? So I thought I'd never see her again. And the revenge in my mind was, I will show her. I can also do that. Is it because I was a scientist and she was really totally from the humanities? And there came this explosion of poetry. So why poetry? Because after that, I then wrote a novel about her and me, a novel that had never been published. So I went for poetry. But why poetry first? Because I've read a fair amount of poetry. I've been always a reader. I've read a lot of fiction and so on. I had a great advantage. I was brought up during the days of no TV, so during a time when people actually read and didn't just sit around and had to be forced to read. She taught poetry and poetics at Stanford, taught one of the great courses on Wallace Stevens, and I actually wrote a couple of things then about Wallace Stevens, and I became a complete Wallace Stevens fan. So to give an example, and although you have a poet who writes incredibly sophisticated, complicated English, and you have to analyze, and he has messages in a few lines. And I made this point in the poem that I just quoted to you. You know, you can condense things in poetry that you can never do in prose, because in poetry, first of all, you don't need entire sentences, so to speak. That doesn't mean that it can be wild. There can be very interesting structural requirements for the poetry, but it's a condensation that is, I think, extremely important. And because there's such, in good poetry, there's so many metaphors and hidden wordplays and so on, you can hide things, even the, and some of the great confessional poets in their play, I don't know, Robert Lowell, let's say, or Anne Sexton, people like that, you know, have done this marvelously rather than writing an autobiography. In my case, it was not an autobiography, I kept a diary. And I wrote these, I must have written at least 60, 70 poems during perhaps 2 or 3 months. I'd never kept a diary before. And in this here, in these poems, I really wrote about, I wrote about myself, and not in a hagiographic PR sort of way, but rather critical. I wrote about my wife who left me in a complimentary and yet also critical way. Then I wrote about other women, because the way I then tried to solve my problem is obviously through other women. And then I described myself as a man, and so on and so forth. And there was a diary for about 3 or 4 months. And I don't think I could have written diaries otherwise, just, you know, what he did during the day. And this, of course, was a demonstration of how I felt during the day, which is quite different from what I did. Did mostly chemistry and traveling and lecturing. And I think I got, it was a catharsis, but an extremely important catharsis, which I think only the medium of poetry, its conciseness and its the hidden meanings and the fact that people accept that you talk behind a veil frequently is what led me to that. But then, you see, I was not satisfied. The moment I did that, I said, well, all right, now I'm going to get down to brass tacks. I'm going to really write a novel. And a novel is exactly the opposite. In a particular novel, not short stories where they've got to be concise. Novel, yeah, it can be a 500-page novel. You just keep on going. And this is not an ideal way of learning autodidactically how to become a writer. And, of course, I didn't have that intention at that time. So
how did
this.
You choose the title for your poetry collection, A Diary of Peak?
Because it is really, it's negative feelings. And I didn't
anger
want to.
And,
yeah,
and
I, but I thought peak is more elegant. It really is more elegant, you know. There are all, that is the beauty about the English language.
Yes,
you know, there are synonyms for just about everything. But I have to tell you, I thought a great deal about what to use. But peak, I even like the sound of it, you know, peak. And it actually, if you look at it, you know, it has a double title, as a German one. Well, Diary, Tagebuch. But then peak, and the German one is Groll. Well, Groll, you know, it's almost like
a growl.
Yeah, growl. It is that, of course. And, you know, peak is not. There's an element of elegance.
I found a lot of humor running, even though the poetry in A Diary of Peak is about pain and loneliness and hurt. There's also a lot of humor when you write a poem like Hair Shirt, or you have a line in a poem called Poetic Justice where you say, may your new lover break out in hives.
Yes, I just, you know. It's interesting enough you're saying that, because that's, you know, that's exactly the one I thought of. Yeah.
Can you choose a poem from your collection? You read the one Why Are Chemists Not Poets as at the opening, but could you choose another one from this collection to read for us?
Yes. Let me give you something totally different. Now I'm showing off. Because what I really, of course, want to do is people to rush out to bookstores and actually buy it and read it on their own. Because I want to give you something that you'd think someone who is just revengeful would not write this. But here I'm showing off. First of all, I'll pick this one here. Namely, it is a poem that is called Two Egyptians Being Served by a Nazi. Now, yeah, that's already an interesting title. And and the epigraph, it's based on Wallace Stevens, it's really a collage, is that Wallace Stevens, in his quote, is saying, someone mentioned that, Two Egyptians Being Served by a Nazi, and he said, gee, that's a good title for a poem. And now I'm writing that poem. And that poem was eventually published in the Wall Stevens Journal, and I suspect that I'm the only chemist in the world who's ever published in the Wall Stevens Journal. I've published a number of ones. And why do I mention this? Because, of course, I got into Wall Stevens through my wife, at that time, through the woman who left me. Now, I didn't finish the story. A year later, she wrote me a letter and said, would like to talk what happened. I said, of course I want to talk about what happened. And she had sent me a letter and flowers, and I sent her the manuscript of my novel. And that was, in a way, brought us together. And eventually we decided to marry, but only if I promised her never to publish that novel. And, of course, I did promise her that. I did not promise not to cannibalize it, and I've cannibalized portions of it in many different things about it. So here, but here comes the Wallace Stevens thing. Actually, now, excuse me, I changed my mind because there's another Wallace Stevens poem, and that deals directly with my wife. So I think I'll do it, and that's called Vocalissima, because I called my wife always called me chemist, not darling or sweetheart or something, chemist.
But was that said in an insulting way?
But she did it in a very affectionate sort of way.
And then I have to ask what you called her.
I called her Vocalissima, and again, and here you'll see why. And I read you the shortest poem that Wallace Stevens ever wrote. It's called To the Roaring Wind, and it has only four lines. What syllable are you seeking, Vocalissimus, in the distances of sleep? Speak it. That's it. And so my poem, which is called Vocalissima, he said Vocalissimus. He said, Vocalissimus Stevens, or is it Wallace Vocalissimus? What familiarity do you permit? You wrote about women. Sweet-smelling virgins, trembling ladies, peached and ivory wenches, beautiful bareness and sinewy nakedness. You call them Liebchen, Mon Bijou, Mon Extase, even a pearly poetess. You name them Carlotta, Eulalia, and Flora, Mariana, Bavda, and Susanna, Bonnie and Vincentine, lean, heavenly Vincentine, more formally, Mrs. Anderson, Mrs. Dooley, Mrs. Papadopoulos. I knew one who knew you. After your death, she lived with you. I should say she got her PhD in Yale on Wallace Stevens. 3 long years, day in, day out, immersed in your poems, savoring each morsel, she learned by heart each word you wrote, thus meeting your rose rabbi, your darker rabbi, your doctor of Geneva, even your uncle with a monocle, who'd asked, shall I uncrumple this much crumpled thing? In time she uncrumpled many men, then one, a modern alchemist. But he, master of chemical mutations, whose alchemy touched millions, could not transform her, nor transform himself. Crumpled, she left. Vocalissima, speak it. How does a modern alchemist transmute himself into a Vocalissimus? I think it's probably a better one to pick because I'm showing what I learned about Wallace Stevens, and yet, of course, a very intimate thing addressed to her and really saying, mm-hmm. I obviously did not become what you wanted me to become.
And how did your wife come into your territory if you came so far into hers by going from being a chemist to a writer? She is a writer by nature. How did she cross the line over into what might be called your territory?
She didn't. She didn't. She seduced me to come into hers. And I would say within 2 years after our marriage, I decided I want to become a writer. Then not anymore for revenge motives, but for intellectual ones. And she encouraged me in doing this and gave me immediately a piece of advice in saying, if you really want to do it, I mean, all you've shown is you have discipline. Now you have to show whether you can do it. And said, if so, start on short stories, because then you really can learn how to write. And then she, one summer, that was the year after got married, was director of the Stanford program at Oxford, and I became a faculty husband for the first time in my life. So I came to Oxford and I bought the groceries and prepared lunch and so on and wrote short stories during that time. And I wrote 12, and it's the first thing I've ever published. And it's interesting, University of Wisconsin, about 3 weeks ago, accepted that collection, which I had written nearly 30 years ago, well, 25 years ago, which had never been published in the United States. They've been published in English, in German, in Italian, in Chinese, never in the United States. So it'll come out next year, and it's called How I Beat Coca-Cola and Other Stories of One-Upmanship. But this is all really things that are, that's how I learned how to write through her. So she encouraged me to leave chemistry, leave science.
Did you mean to leave it completely without just having writing as a sideline?
Well, no, I never left it completely because after 50 years you're imprinted, first of all. So my thought processes are differently. But then I, even though I was much older than she then decided at age 62 or so to become emerita and wanted to be a full-time biographer. Whereas I said, I want to be the Strom Thurmond of academia. I want to be the first 100-year-old still active professor at Stanford. And then, and, you know, I closed my lab, but I kept on teaching. And then one day in London, my wife said, you know, why don't you just stop being that machismo, this macho, you know, Strom Thurmond type, and do what you really want to do, be a full-time writer. And we got home. We lived in London and San Francisco, and sent an email to our chairman, said, I'm retiring as of the 1st of April next year. I don't think he caught the meaning of the 1st of April. And I then moved completely. If you ask me who I am now, I'm not saying I'm a chemist. I'm an author who was a chemist. So she did not have to make that transition. I made a transition to her, and it changed completely my social life in that many of my social acquaintances turned out to be primarily people from literature, journalism, playwrights, and things like this, rather than chemists. I have, you know, many chemical friends, but they're all from an earlier life who are now all old, whereas the new friends, the people that I meet continuously, come from that other area.
And you're also a passionate art collector as well.
But that I always was.
That's always been
that there. I always was. That was a separate issue.
We'll look further into the life and literature of Carl Gerassi when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Here I am. Stefania said you want to see me.
Sit down.
What was the conclusion?
Sit down.
Quit stalling.
It's difficult these days.
Every day is difficult. So what's special about this one?
The budget, for one.
You're playing a broken record.
True, but it's even tougher now with the new provost. The departmental recommendations should be unanimous.
That's a rule, Noah?
Well, not exactly a rule. It's a guideline, but a strong one.
Why?
We shouldn't give the dean excuses not to forward to the provost.
And you aren't prepared to make exceptions?
Well, there are always exceptions, but your case wouldn't be one.
Because I'm not a woman, or physically disabled, or a minority? Listen, I've been a minority of one since the day I joined this department. The only foreigner who joined the third-rate university, who accepted an associate professorship without tenure at age 39, when I had more experience than most of your tenured faculty in his lousy
now
department.
Now, wait a moment.
I'm not finished. Because I needed a green card to immigrate, and you and the provost assured me it was only a matter of a couple of years and I could be put up for tenure?
Please, pull yourself together.
So what was the vote?
What's the difference? It's unanimity that counts.
What was the vote?
17-3.
We have 24 faculty members in the department.
Well, the rest abstained.
Cowards. But in that case, 17 votes represent 85% of those voting. Surely that isn't too bad.
Sit down.
I don't want to sit down. I want to know whether you're forwarding the recommendation, even though it's not unanimous.
I can't.
What do you mean you can't?
It was 17 against.
I can't believe that. There can't be 17 jerks voting against me. There are some jerks here, but not 17.
That's a scene from the play Insufficiency by our guest this hour, Carl Gerassi. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we are talking about the art of Carl Gerassi. We've been talking earlier about your work in poetry, also writing fiction novels. Now we're turning to your work as a playwright, and a playwright who deliberately brings in scientists and scientific topics that, you know, whether it's your play Oxygen or, in this case, Insufficiency, about a chemist who is specializing in the study of bubbles. Tell me about your thoughts in writing this play, Insufficiency.
Well, it's my 9th play. And of the 9 plays, 6 actually deal with what I would call science in theater. And in some respects, I think I've been successful because my first play, it's called An Immaculate Misconception, has been translated into 12 languages and broadcast by the BBC World Service, and in fact also by NPR here in this country and a number of other countries. My second play, Oxygen, which I wrote with a Nobel laureate, Roald Hoffman, has been translated in 19 languages. It's not that they're playing in Lincoln Center, but they've been played all over the world and are still being played. So in that respect, I've accomplished something, but I've really accomplished it in spite of, instead of because of what I'm writing. I've found that, and that's the sort of discontent I described earlier in my autobiography, I find the theaters, and I'm talking about here all over the world, but particularly in English and in Europe, are pathologically afraid of writing anything about science. And if you tell this to them and said, well, you know, we do play everyone's Brecht's Galileo or Dürer's The Physicist, and 12 years ago, Michael Frayn's Copenhagen, but these are the exceptions that unfortunately prove the rule. I mean, I'm not saying these are bad plays, on the contrary, but that's nothing compared to the thousands of plays that people have played. And there is that fear. Fear partly of the didactic aspects, that people just are not interested in this. Well, you can't say that unless you prove it, and you don't expose them to these things, so you can't tell whether they're not interested. So I really felt very strongly that I want to write about subjects like this, where you have both excitement, amusement, you also learn something, there's humor, there's laughter, and so on. But I've done an experiment which I do not believe any contemporary writer or theater author has done, or in fact that they really even agree with it. And I have described this in detail in the foreword to the book that is in front of us called Chemistry in Theater, which contains the text of Insufficiency. But it is this foreword that I need to explain because it's important. Namely, I feel very strongly, in Madison, Wisconsin would be a very good example of this, that because you have a very small theater scene here. You used to have the Madison Rep, which I think has gone belly up. Theater scene is primarily the University of Wisconsin. So they have obviously a limited repertoire because they only can do so many things. That most plays, it makes no difference, you can talk about Shakespeare, if you wish, are not performed. I don't mean that they're never performed, but they're not performed. So if you want to see, I don't imagine there's a Hamlet or a Lear right now in Madison, or probably not even Milwaukee, and probably not even in Chicago. So what do? You read it. Mm-hmm. And you read it because you're accustomed to reading the canonical plays, whether they're Shakespeare, Goethe, or, you know, Molière, or Chekhov. We should think about this in the context of contemporary plays, not of all plays. There are plenty of plays that only consist of nothing but primarily four-letter words that are played amusingly but read terribly. Mm-hmm. But there are quite a number of plays with a real literary context, a real interesting text, a really interesting plot. And I would give an example, probably my favorite playwright, Tom Stoppard, to use that as an example, or Alan Bennett, to take two English ones. And well, you could say that, of course, with Tennessee Williams or mm-hmm. Arthur Miller and so on like this, which are wonderful reading. People
they
don't
are.
And people
sometimes
don't read them as book.
Right.
The only people who read them are either people who have seen it or who are going to see it, or somehow someone drives them to this. But no one goes, not no one, but few people go to a bookstore and say, I would like to buy Tom Stoppard's Arcadia or mm-hmm. Alan Bennett's History Boys or something like this. Well, they're making a mistake. I think it's wonderful reading. It's very amusing reading. entertaining, but it has a great advantage over other reading, that whether you know it or not, when you read a play, you play it in your mind.
Sure, you kind of speak the dialogue.
You're doing every role. Mm-hmm. And then the next step that often is the case, and is a wonderful one, if you have a partner, friend, or someone, say, come, let's read it together.
Just like we just did.
Exactly what we did just now.
Just now, because, yes.
And remember, a person who read it with me had never read this before. So it was really completely fresh. And you could see he read this. He was not stumbling over it. So I have become so interested in this that I said I want to prove people that you can do this.
Well, let's talk about insufficiency a little bit. Your main character, the one that we just heard getting denied tenure, he thought the 17 votes were in favor, but it turned out not to be. Yet he's a brilliant scientist. He has industry behind him in his work on bubbles. What were some of the themes that you were hoping would come across in the portrayal of this Polish immigrant?
Well, there were three main themes. That's a very good question that you ask, because it isn't just telling a story. I obviously had a reason for telling the story. The first one is fashion in science. This is a topic that we don't discuss very much. But in fact, this becomes quite crucial, many of the scientists realize, because you always need money for your research. And if it's not fashionable, you don't get money. But what does fashionable really mean? And then the same thing in the local level, if you need tenure and you need tenure or out you go, there's no question that you get tenure for fashionable research. So in this case, but frequently fashionable also means that people don't understand what you're working on and therefore have a tendency to dismiss it and say, well, it's not really important. So I then chose a topic that I myself knew really nothing about, which is bubbliology, now the science of bubbles. And that to anyone, whether it's scientists, that sounds amusing.
Yeah,
childish.
And especially if you add the study of the bubbles in beer, it seems like the kind of thing that senators would get hold of and give golden fleece awards.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, in point of fact, it's extremely complicated. And this man, and what I describe is a real science of bubbles, because I then looked it up and I met some people who work on this here, in particular one in France who, in the case of Champagne, has really worked on the mathematics of this, which is really very tough. But then from then on, it goes all the way to quantum foam. I don't want to try to explain it, but then bubbles, it turns out, have even something to do with cosmology and with fractal nature. So if you go through all of these things, you find out, in fact, there are all kinds of applications. But people don't know this. They don't take the trouble, of course, of reading this. So they dismiss it. So that's point number one. And that is one thing that I want to show. What did I pick is Polish sign, the Polish immigrant, with an unpronounceable name. Because I wanted to, I came as an immigrant, although I'm talking about a different time. I'm talking about now. But there's an element of xenophobia, which you have everywhere. I'm not talking about just in America or in America. It's true, perhaps even more so, and you see it flowering all over in France and in Germany and in Italy and even Sweden, England. So I want to show that even in academia, where it is officially denied, there's an unconscious one, the outsider. It's not that you don't let him in, but you make it plain he's an outsider. And it starts right here. He rushes in the department, the chairman's office. He was very excited. He wants to show him what they just found, this terrific thing with bubbles. And the man says, listen, haven't you ever heard of knocking on a door? Even in Poland, I presume they do this. Sort of gestures. And he, of course, discovers also that he does not completely assimilate and that there are certain things that he is not prepared to do. They want him to publish all the time. He said, I don't believe in salami by publishing, taking a piece of thing and cutting up into five units and publishing five papers from one and things like this. So I wanted to really illustrate that. And then I thought I'd package it in whodunit. So it actually, there are four academics, and one prosecuting attorney.
And a couple of dead bodies.
Mm-hmm. And the question is, how did they die, and did he kill them or not? And you don't know that even at the end. And that's, again, feature of my plays. I always like to end them ambiguously, whereas most people say you should always tie all the knots in a play, and I just don't like to do that, and I haven't done it here. But I think this is a sophisticated play, and the reviews are very good in London, and I saw the audience participation. In fact, it was very nice. For one performance, there's a an institution called the Institute of Ideas in England, which has all kinds of symposia and discussion on different topics all over the UK. And they actually took over one performance, and then had a panel afterwards for a discussion with the audience, which was very engaging. I wasn't there anymore, but they sent me a DVD of it, and it was very nice to see that. So I think that's the sort of place that I... that on the whole I like to write.
And ones that stir discussion,
yes.
I guess. Final question. If you imagine, you're about to celebrate your 90th birthday, if you imagine writing until you're 100, in those 10 years, what do you hope to write?
Well, I can actually tell you what I'm going to write, okay. Because I am, of course, writing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just finished. This was a major job, this autobiography that I mentioned. I've now returned to novel. And this is a novel that I started in roughly 96 or 97. So, you know, that's 13, 14 years ago, which I thought is a very good novel. And I'd written maybe 40, 50 pages, and I knew what I would say in the next 100 pages. And then I decided to write this play, An Immaculate Misconception. There was a reason. I saw something in London and said, I can do this sort of thing. My wife, of course, looked at me sort of amused and said, well, what next? Next thing you're going to tell me to write an opera, something like this. But in this case, of course, I wrote from strength, because what I wanted to talk about then is reproductive medicine. And of course, that's... I give lectures on this all the time. And the title was An Immaculate Misconception. The subtitle was Sex in an Age of Mechanical Reproduction. Well, if people who know something about Walter Benjamin already understand where I got this title. He wrote the famous essay Art in an Age of Mechanical Reproduction. But then, secondly, I'm writing about this because I am predicting that in the future, fertile people will use, you know, store their eggs and sperm, and will wonder if a child use in vitro fertilization. That's another subject for another broadcast. But I wanted to write this. And then I was going to go back to a novel. But I got hooked instead by theater writing, and then I decided to write a second, a third, and fourth. And before I knew it, I was writing plays for 15 years. But now, as I'm facing really the realities of that I'm not going to live forever, who knows how long, I wanted to stop for a moment writing plays, go back to fiction. And decided to go back to that one. And I'm also doing another experiment. I'm writing that novel now, finishing together with someone, which I've never done before in terms of a fiction, someone named Laura Roberts. She's not a professional writer, but she's a fantastic writer. I mean, fantastic. She has a ability of metaphors that I simply don't have. She has a metaphor for every second sentence that you write. But much more importantly, the novel is placed into Texas. And I'm not a Texan. I'm not a Texan. I don't speak that lingo, as you can clearly see. I don't even think as a Texan. And she comes from there. And this is the ideal thing. And it's been a very interesting collaboration because we're doing it by email. She lives in Maine and I'm in Vienna, London, or San Francisco. But we are making very substantial progress. And I think we'll be able to finish that in a year or so. And that's a very tough. I'm glad that I postponed it for 14 years because it deals with the brain, that child, that instead of disconnecting all life support, kept alive because they thought maybe that some things will happen in the neurosciences. And it did, of course. Enormous things happened. Stem cell research was not even known at that time. And so I'm bringing all this in with a very surprising end. So I think it fits in very well into my science and fiction series. And it also started, I never like to leave unfinished things unfinished. So I really am focusing now on completing that novel. It's the tentative title is, I used to call it originally The Sleeping Beauty Syndrome, but it actually will be called the Glass Harmonica.
Hmm.
And I won't explain to you why there's a glass harmonica, but, you know, because we like Günter Grass as a tin drum.
Sure.
So it's words like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations to you on all your accomplishments, and including the recent Distinguished Alum Award from UW-Madison for your work both in science and in art. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Carl Gerassi. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. ¶¶